This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. As you might suspect of somebody who spent a couple of years as the band leader on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, saxophonist Branford Marsalis is funny as well as being a great musician. Branford is from one of the best-known families in jazz. One of his brothers is the trumpeter and composer Wynton Marsalis. We'll hear from him later in the show. Their father is pianist Ellis Marsalis. Branford has had several different public identities as a musician. His group, Buckshot LaFunk, combined jazz and hip-hop. In the pop world, he's performed with Sting, The Grateful Dead, and Bruce Hornsby. And he's recorded many jazz albums as the leader of the Branford Marsalis Quartet. His latest recording is a collection of ballads called Eternal. From that CD, here's The Ruby and the Pearl, a ballad made famous by Nat King Cole. The Ruby and the Pearl, from the new Branford Marsalis CD, Eternal. Terry Gross spoke with Branford in 2002. He told her about a turning point in his life, hearing the John Coltrane recording, A Love Supreme.
I think I was probably at the Berklee College of Music the first time I heard it, or maybe it was at my dad's house, 18, 19, something.
But what year would this be about?
78, 79, 77, somewhere around there. I was very uncomfortable. Because I just had, there was nothing that I'd ever done or listened to in my life that could adequately prepare me for that experience. And there was a lot of discomfort on my end. I just wanted them to turn it off as quickly as possible.
What was making you so uncomfortable?
It's just when you hear something that you've never heard before. It's something that I see in a lot of people the first time they hear jazz. And the first time they hear it played well, or the first time they hear it played differently than what they're used to hearing on a lot of jazz radio stations. And I remember it well because I just didn't have anything to reference it to. I was a kid. I grew up listening to Elton John and Led Zeppelin. And
but your father, Ellis Marsalis, is a pianist who plays jazz, so you grew up hearing
that
too.
That's what he did.
Right.
That's not what I did.
Right.
I was a kid, and I listened to a lot of pop music. And I had a couple of Charlie Parker records that I'd learned some solos from. One was called Fiesta, and it was like Bird playing with a Latin percussion section. The record's really corny, which lends me to believe, you know, Norman Grant's had a big hand in that one, because, you know, it's like with my blue suede shoes and all these really little cute pop ditties. And Bird plays his tail off, but they're short solos, one chorus, at tops, two choruses. On short 12 and 16 bar forms. And I just never, that John Coltrane train thing, Love Supreme, it just comes out like, you know, Elvin's hitting a gong, and the music comes in, and you're just like, man, what is this? I didn't really have an understanding of the blues. I mean, I knew that the blues was a 12 bar form, but I didn't really have any real personal understanding of the blues idiom and its impact on jazz. And the first movement of A Love Supreme is basically straight blues. So I just wasn't intellectually or professionally or, you know, musically prepared for the onslaught.
Well, why don't we hear your version of A Love Supreme? We'll hear the opening movement.
Great. Thank you.
Up in what is now America's probably most famous jazz family, the Marsalis family. Your father, Ellis Marsalis, is a pianist. When you were growing up liking the pop music that you liked, did you feel about his music the way, say, I felt about my father's old Benny Goodman records?
I felt about my father's music the way that my next-door neighbor felt about his father, the chauffeur driver. That was just what he did.
Uh-huh.
How did you feel about your father's
Benny
Goodman records?
I guess I didn't. I really disliked them until I got much older.
Well,
in my 20s, anyways.
Jazz is not for kids. And I know there's an argument. My brother says jazz can be for kids. I don't think jazz has a level of sophistication that's just way too hip for kids. It's not a music for kids, and it certainly wasn't a music for me. But it wasn't like he'd play them and I'd go, arr. I would just leave the room.
He just didn't care.
And turn on the television in the other room until it was my turn to listen to my music. And then I put on Cheech and Chong and Elton John and James Brown and whatever I wanted to put on. And my father would stay out. And then when James Brown came on, he'd come in and say, yeah, kid, yeah, Jack, I like that. And then he would always dance to it. When he danced to it, he would snap his fingers on 2 and 4, which was the funniest thing in the world. You know?
That's great.
You know,
yeah.
Cold
yeah.
sweats going on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like a cold sweat. Dun, dun, dun. Do, bang, da, do, do, dee, dee. My father's going, yeah. I'm like, no, Dad. It's just funny.
It's on the one.
Oh yeah, it was classic.
Oh, that's great. So, what was your first instrument?
My first instrument was the piano. And then when I was a freshman, when I was in the first grade or second grade, went and started playing the trumpet. And I wanted to play an instrument, so I said, I want to play the trumpet. And my father says, no, we're not going to have two people playing the same instrument in the same household. So you have to pick something else. So, okay, clarinet. Okay, fine, you get the clarinet. And I played the clarinet for 7 years until I was a sophomore in high school, and then I switched to the alto saxophone because I wanted to be in a funk band.
Yeah, that's the thing. There are no clarinets in funk bands.
And if there were, it would be really bad. It wouldn't work. It wouldn't be a good vibe at all.
How did you end up feeling about clarinet when you were playing it? Because they weren't featured at all in the kind of pop music you were listening to. Not Elton John or James Brown.
I was in the orchestra. I was in the wind ensemble. I didn't care. You know, I wasn't. That was like a separate thing. That was the music
right.
I liked, but it wasn't necessarily the music. You know, the only of all that music, the only time I ever envisioned myself being on stage doing it was when I was listening to Elton John religiously, and I would play the piano and I'd learn all his songs. You know, Burn on the Mission and, you know, Daniel and Rocket Man, and I'd play the piano and say, one day I'm going to be on the stage playing these songs on the piano. When I stopped playing piano, that whole thing went away. Because you go from being the front man to in the horn section, which is like a whole different thing. It's not really the most romantic gig in the world to be in the horn section of a rock star or, you know, a pop band. It's just, you're just in the horn section. That's the way it goes. So playing clarinet was fine for me. It was a different thing.
Once you got into the horn sections of bands, what are some of the bands in which you were in the horn section?
Oh, well, the one that we had in New Orleans was a band we called the Mighty Creators. And it was the funniest band. It was an R&B band. And there was another band that went and joined and got me into called Killer Force and the Crispy Critters. And then there was one other band that I can't remember the name of. But the band we spent the most time in was the Creators. What was that other band I was in? Stop Incorporated. I played keyboard. And Stop Incorporated. And it was another band called that other rival bands, Jam Incorporated and Flashback and all these bands, Chocolate Milk. And the Creators were interesting because I learned a lot about, I don't know what you really call it, but we had a band that was probably technically the best funk band in New Orleans. I mean, we could play music that these other guys could only dream of playing. But we weren't a funky band at all. Our drummer and bass player just didn't have groove. So we would be playing all this music and all the musicians would be there. And the audience would just be bored to tears hearing us play because they couldn't feel anything. And then the next band, a band like Flashback, would come on where they didn't have half the technique we had. And they would just hit a simple groove, and then the people would just be up and dancing and going crazy and loving it. And it was like a really good lesson.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, you can sit around, like a good friend of mine, Rob Hunter, my engineer, he calls them talent attacks. You know, you can get on stage and have a talent attack, and the musicians might be impressed, but the regular audience, the lay people, could give a damn. You know, and I've always wanted it to be very important that when I'm playing, that I don't have an audience full of musicians and music students. That was always something that was really kind of important to me. And it's strange because I don't really believe that as a musician I should reach out to the audience. It doesn't mean I should treat them like garbage. That's not what I'm saying, but it's just when you're trying to make music that is a personal statement of your own, you can't really worry about whether the audience gets it or not, whether the audience likes it or not. You have to do it, but at the same time, I wouldn't want to look out in the audience. Like, there's some musicians we have where, like, the majority of their fan base are, like, people who play the same instrument. And that's kind of like the talent attack crew, you know? And I never wanted to be a part of the talent attack crew because I remember being a part of that when I was with the Mighty Creators, and I didn't dig it very much. I didn't dig it very much.
So was it fun to be in the, I mean, I always thought it would be fun to be in the saxophone section of a band.
It was great in that band.
Yeah, because particularly, like, well, in some of the showier bands, the section would move their horns to the left and to the right in rhythm
that.
And, you know, kind of synchronized. It would be very cool.
We did all of that. And then we were in marching bands and drum and bugle corps.
Don't you love marches? I mean, as corny.
Oh,
as
we
corny
weren't in that kind
be,
of marching
oh,
band.
No?
But I did that as well. Yeah, yeah, those Sousa marches, they're
yeah,
great.
Yeah, they're great, yeah.
I played piccolo when we did Stars and Stripes Forever, and we didn't have a piccolo player. So, and on this one particular performance, George Marks, our music director, wanted to play Stars and Stripes and have the piccolos, the band spreads in the formation and the piccolos play marching down the center of the field. And we only had one piccolo player, and George, because I was like the jack of all trades, when they needed an oboe player for the Christmas thing, he says, "You ever played oboe?" I says, "No." He says, "Well, you got 6 weeks, here you go." You know, and I stumbled around with it, took a couple of lessons and got good enough to pass for the Christmas play. And it was like the bizarre experience to have this guy, he's giving me these strange instruments and have me do them for these Christmas concerts. I did enjoy it.
Branford Marsalis speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2002 interview with jazz saxophonist Branford Marsalis.
So what was the transition for you from going from the like high school guy playing in local funk and R&B bands
mm-hmm.
to starting to take jazz seriously?
I was at the Berklee College of Music, and I was basically studying production. Playing jazz kind of on the side, not really, you know.
Production, like, is it
funk,
producing records?
Producing records, mm-hmm. You know. Quincy Jones. I'm going to be next Quincy Jones. I'm going to hire musicians and put them with certain musicians and, you know, do that thing, you know. Because I did have a knack and still do kind of have a knack for knowing which musicians fit in which musical situations well. And I was playing with this R&B singer named William Bell, who had this big R&B hit called Trying to Love 2. And he had a review. Because with R&B singers, when you have a hit, you have a band, or you have a show, you know, William Bell. When you don't have a hit and you get on the Chitlin circuit, they call it a review, William Bell and his review, and we were part of the review. And I was playing with him in a town called, it's called Worcester.
In New England?
Yeah, it was about 40 minutes away from Boston. That same night, Wynton was playing with Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers at a club in Boston. And I was playing in the band, and we did our show. And at the end of the night, William Bell turns around and says, you know, let's give a round of applause for the boys in the band. And the audience applauded for the boys in the band. And then I left, and I said, I'm going to hear my brother play with our Blakey. And it struck me, the difference between the two. And in my contract, we were one of the boys in the band. You go to the jazz club, and Art introduces everybody in the band. You know, Wynton Marsalis on trumpet, Billy Pierce on tenor saxophone, Bobby Watson on alto saxophone, Charles Fambro on bass, James Williams on piano, you know, yours truly, you know, Mrs. Blakey's one and only Bambino, yours truly, Arturo Blakey, me. You know, and he would do his thing, and I was kind of struck by it. I said, wow, man, guys, they get introduced and respected as individuals. They get to play solos. You know, it's like a much hipper thing than being one of the boys in the band. So I after that concert, I told Wynton, I said, man, I think I want to play jazz. And he started laughing. He says, you? Get out of here. Because, you know, it was known that I just could care less. I said, no, I think, man, this concert really inspired me to play. He's like, yeah, okay, whatever, we'll see. Called my dad. So I saw Wynton last night playing, and it was something else, man, and I think I want to start playing jazz. He laughs. No, man, you play jazz? Get out of here. And about 6 months later, they were like, oh, okay, because I really got into it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you ended up joining Blakey's band. While Wynton was still in it. How much longer later was that?
2 years.
Mm-hmm.
2 years later.
What did you get from being in Blakey's band?
Blakey was a wonderful band leader.
Yeah, I should say, you know, for people who aren't familiar with it, like the Jazz Messengers, it's considered almost like going to jazz school or something.
Jazz University.
And a lot of great players came out of that band.
A lot of great players. Some Freddie Hubbard and Lee Morgan and Wayne Shorter and I think George Coleman and Bobby Watson and Billy Pierce and Hank Mobley played in that band. And
so what did it do for you?
Art Blakey taught me the function of drums, not only within the context of a rhythm section, but in the context of a group, and how the drummer can actually help the soloist build the solo. And we talked about it. Rather than just being off in the corner doing his own thing, you know, you see those drummers with their heads turned to the left and they're just playing and thinking about what they're playing and not paying attention. He really pays attention to what you play. He paid attention to what you played, and he was on it.
And that gave you certain support and direction?
Well, it made me understand that the music was a lot more intricate than it seems on the outside when you just sit around thinking about playing your own chord changes. And, you know, he would use these really coarse jokes to illustrate points that he would never really explain. You'd have to come to it on your own.
What do you mean?
I was playing a ballad once. There's an old joke about a grandfather and a grandson and some cows walking down a hill. And I'm not really going to get into the joke now because it's too risque. But it's basically a joke that illuminates the difference between young people who rush into things and older people who have learned to take their time. And I'm playing this solo, and Art, when he plays ballads, he would always have a part at the end, and then the musician gets to play a cadenza. And in the cadenza, that's when you get to show your stuff, and you're ripping through. And at the end of one night, he says, hey, Bradford, and he tells me this joke. And I'm like, what in the hell is that supposed to mean? It took me a week about to figure it out. It took about a week. And then the next time I played the ballad, he says, oh, you figured it out. You're walking now. And I said, okay, great. And I believe in that so much now that I don't play cadenzas on ballads because they're pointless. The only reason you play it is to show off your technical prowess. And, I mean, my technique is not anywhere near the top 20 as far as I'm concerned. So it doesn't really have – it's not germane to the body of work. So I just eliminate them from my playing completely.
Was it a good thing to be in the band the same time as your brother Wynton?
Well, it was interesting because – I really try hard not to delude myself. And sometimes, under the guise of honesty, I would delude myself. But in this one, I know for a fact that the only reason that I was even in the band was because Art knew that Wynton really wanted to play in a band with me. And Art thought that if he hired me, then Wynton would stay in his band longer. I have no illusions about this at all. And that's the only reason I got to play with Art.
Here's Branford Marsalis and his brother Wynton in 1982 when they were part of the band Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. This is In Walked Bud.
Branford and Wynton Marsalis with Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. We'll hear more about the Marsalis family in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with saxophonist Branford Marsalis. He has a new CD of ballads called Eternal on the Marsalis Music label. They spoke in 2002.
Now, Wynton is younger than you
yes.
are, but he was...
Most people assume he's older.
But he was more serious about jazz before you
oh,
were.
Oh, yeah, way more.
And he got you into the Blakey Band, and then you played in his band. Was it awkward for you then, being the older brother, knowing that your younger brother was making more headway in
no.
jazz and was more serious about it sooner than you were?
No, because I wasn't. You know what I mean? I think it would have been more difficult if I had been really trying and...
Right.
I was really serious, because then it's an issue of well, I'm just not good enough.
Was your temperament musically different, too, about, like, how serious you needed to be?
I was just a strange person. And I was really into music then. I wasn't really into music the way my brother is. We think about it in different ways. I was more into the sort of almost metaphysical interaction that good musicians have with one another. And I was a huge fan of music. I used to listen and still do listen to all types of music, just using, trying to find ways to incorporate those things organically, not peripherally, but organically into my conception. And Wynton was going headstrong into the quintet concept. This particular band, writing songs for the band, arrangements. He was always like, you don't write songs. You should need to write songs. I mean, I really wasn't into writing songs at that time. I was still checking out music and trying to figure out what it was that I wanted to do musically. I wasn't so sure what that was, and I wasn't really ready to put the lion's share of my energy into something until I was absolutely certain what it was.
It's interesting hearing you talk about your musical development and how jazz is something you got interested in. You know, in your late teens, after when you were in college, you have left jazz a couple of times, and you know, in 1985 you joined Sting's band,
right?
And you spent I forget how long on the Tonight Show as the band leader there. And although you were often playing jazz on the show, it still wasn't within the jazz world per se. And then you've done, you know, like your Buckshot LaFunk. Music, which
right.
is a like jazz hip hop hybrid,
mm-hmm.
And these are things that the jazz world were necessarily really enthusiastic about,
right.
and I think it's fair to say, with some of the stuff you were perceived as almost like betraying the jazz community by leaving it,
yeah.
for instance, in joining Sting. But the way you're describing your musical interest, it sounds more like a continuum than a turning your back
well,
on something.
Well, it is a continuum, and. My mother said something to me which holds true to me to this day. We joke about it now. I was 7 or 8, 5, and, you know, you're going to practice. I was 8, and I was playing piano. And I had a duo recital with a young lady named Barbara Krause, and we had to play this piano duo. And my mother's, you know, you're going to practice. I said, I got it. I got the piece. I don't feel like practicing, you know? And she was just on me. You're going to fail if you don't practice. You're going to, you know. So the night before the concert, she's like, are you going to work on this piece or not? I says, no, I'm not. And she grabs me by the shoulders and she says, you know what the problem with you is? You are a little boy who wants to do what he wants to do. That was great. And I never forgot it. So then the concert comes up, and we come out on stage. And when I come out on stage, my mother gets up and walks out of the room. So I'm thinking, well, humph, she's just trying to, you know, be mad at me because I didn't practice. I'll show her. And, I mean, I aced the piece, you know. It's not like we're talking about Rachmaninoff here. It was like 8-year-old stuff. I mean, I played it. And then she was looking in the like one of those doors with the little square window. She was looking in the square. I mean, now that I know my mother a lot better, I realized she gets nervous for us.
Right.
She was so nervous she couldn't sit. And I, you know, like when the first night of the Tonight Show came, I mean, she wouldn't even fly to L.A. She was like, I'm too nervous. She wouldn't even watch the show. She was in the other room, and she would call my dad and say, how's he doing out there, honey? So he's sitting there. He looks fine. She just wouldn't. She's just that nervous. But at the time, I was like, oh, so she's going to try to, you know, stick it to me, huh? So when we played the piece and we finished, we bowed and I looked up and saw my mother in the window and I stuck my tongue out at her. So I've always been like, you know, I've always been a little boy who's going to do what he wants to do. And in my musical choices, it has never been a dream of mine to appease or please the jazz community. It has never been a dream of mine to appease or please anyone other than me and my immediate family.
Now, you were saying before that you realized after playing in a lot of R&B bands and then seeing your brother Wynton playing with Art Blakey, you realized, you know, in the R&B bands, you were like one of the boys in the band, where if you're playing with a jazz group, you're all significant musicians on stage playing something together.
Mm-hmm.
When you, for instance, joined Sting, did you feel like you were one of the boys in the band again?
No. That was a very, very different thing.
Was it?
We were an integral part of the sound.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like there was a pre-existing sound and we just came in and filled in the parts.
What about on The Tonight Show? How did you feel on the band? Did you feel like an integral part of the show?
No, because the band is not an integral part of the show. The musical director is an integral part of the show. But the music is essentially it's just pure entertainment. I mean, when the commercials come on, you know, and the audience is like I'd never seen anything like it before, because they come to the show and they stand in long lines, and if you ever go to the show, there's little TV screens, little monitors all over the place, so people can see, and it's mostly for the people way in the back, and I mean, people love Jay, and stand in this line to see Jay, and Jay is not even 75 feet from them. And they go, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, the lights go down, and the thing comes up, and all the heads go straight up to the television monitors. And the man is 75 feet from them. He's right there. They don't even look. And then, because it's like a semi-live show, I mean, they don't stop the show for anything unless like a light falls and tries to almost kill someone or something. They're putting the commercials in because they have a narrow window. You know, they're putting the commercials in live during the break because they have to send the feed off to the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, the band's playing, the Jay's getting makeup and people are talking. And I mean, I would be curious enough to want to see what it's like to put on a show. Most of the people in the audience, they look at the commercials, which they can't hear, and they just keep looking up. And it's just the strangest experience to turn around while the band's playing and realize that 70% of your audience is looking up. You know, so it's just it's entertainment.
Right.
It's entertainment in its purest form. It's not, you know, artistic or anything like that.
So tell me, has your father been really pleased over the years that you've come to love jazz and play it?
I mean, I just confused the hell out of my poor dad. My dad was just, he didn't understand me. Now he does. But my whole career to him was just one, because my dad is, he has two words. I mean, he always said, I mean, like typical Ellis Marsalis fashion, he says, yeah, man, you know, you and Wynton are interesting, because see, Wynton's a concrete sequential, and you're a random abstract. I actually named a record Random Abstract because he was saying, I said, what are you talking about, man? Just talk to me like I'm your son. What was this concrete sequential crap, you know? And he went through it, you know, Wynton just things like A, B, C, D, E, F, and you're like A, F, B, Z. And he just didn't understand that, because if you have to really, he's a concrete sequential. So it just seemed like, it seemed just rampant, just like a pell-mell kind of thing. Like, what in the hell is he doing?
Branford Marsalis, speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. He has a new CD on the Marsalis Music label called Eternal.